I therefore now comes the statement. Prime Minister Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. With permission, I'd like to provide the House with information that I now have about the appointment of Peter Mandelson as our ambassador to the United States. But, Mr. Speaker, before I go into the details, I want to be very clear with this House that while this statement will focus on the process surrounding Peter Mandelson's vetting and appointment, at the heart of this, there is also a judgment I made that was wrong. I should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. I take responsibility for that decision, and I apologise again to the victims of the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who were clearly failed by my decision. Mr. Speaker, last Tuesday evening, the 14th of April, I found out for the first time that on the 29th of January 2025, before Peter Mandelson took up his position as ambassador, the Foreign Office officials granted him developed vetting clearance against the specific recommendation of the United Kingdom security vetting that developed vetting clearance should be denied. Not only that, the Foreign Office officials who made that decision did not pass this information to me, to the Foreign Secretary, to her predecessor, the Deputy Prime Minister, to any other minister, or even to the former Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Warmold. I found this staggering, and therefore last Tuesday I immediately instructed officials in Downing Street and the Cabinet Office to urgently establish the facts on my authority. I wanted to know who made the decision, on what basis, who knew, and Mr. Speaker, I wanted that information for the precise and explicit purpose of updating this House. Because this is information I should have had a long time ago. And it is information that this House should have had a long time ago. It is information that I and the House had the right to know. I will now set out a full timeline of the events in the Peter Mandelson process, including from the fact-finding exercise I instructed last Tuesday. Before doing so, I want to remind and reassure the House that the government will comply fully with the humble address motion of the 4th of February. Mr. Speaker, in December 2024, I was in the process of appointing a new ambassador for Washington. A due diligence exercise was conducted by the Cabinet Office into Peter Mandelson's suitability, including questions put to him by my staff in Number 10. Peter Mandelson answered those questions on the 10th of December, and I received final advice on the due diligence process on the 11th. I made the decision to appoint him on the 18th of December. The appointment was announced on the 20th, and the security vetting process began on the 23rd of December, 2024. Mr. Speaker, I want to make clear to the House that for a direct ministerial appointment, it was usual for security vetting to happen after the appointment, but before starting in post. That was the process in place at the time. Mr. Speaker, this was confirmed by the former Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Warmold, at the Foreign Affairs Select Committee on the 3rd of November 2025, when he gave evidence. Sir Chris made clear, and I'm quoting him now, when we are making appointments from outside the civil service, the normal thing is for security clearance to happen after appointment, but before the person signs a contract and takes up post. At the same hearing of the same select committee, the former Permanent Secretary to the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, said, and I quote again, Peter Mandelson did not hold national security vetting when he was appointed, but, he went on, as is normally the case with external appointments to my department and the wider civil service, the appointment was made subject to obtaining security clearance. Mr. Speaker, after I sacked Peter Mandelson, I changed that process so that now an appointment cannot be announced until after security vetting is passed. Mr. Speaker, the security vetting was carried out by UK Security Vetting, UKSV, between the 23rd of December 2024 and the 28th of January 2025. UKSV conducted vetting in the normal way, collecting relevant information as well as interviewing the applicant, in this case, on two occasions. Then on the 28th of January 2025, UKSV recommended to the Foreign Office that developed vetting clearance should be denied to Peter Mandelson. The following day, on the 29th of January 2025, notwithstanding the UKSV recommendation that developed vetting clearance should be denied, Foreign Office officials made the decision to grant developed vetting clearance for Peter Mandelson. To be clear, for many departments, a decision from UKSV is binding. But for the Foreign Office, the final decision on developed vetting clearance is made by Foreign Office officials, not UKSV. However, once the decision in this case came to light, the Foreign Office's power to make the final decision on developed vetting clearance was immediately suspended by my Chief Secretary last week. Mr. Speaker, I accept that the sensitive personal information provided by an individual being vetted must be protected from disclosure. If that were not the case, the integrity of the whole process would be compromised. What I do not accept is that the appointing minister cannot be told of the recommendation by UKSV. Indeed, given the seriousness of these issues and the significance of the appointment, I simply do not accept that Foreign Office officials could not have informed me of UKSV's recommendations whilst also maintaining the necessary confidentiality that vetting requires. There is no law that stops civil servants sensibly flagging UKSV recommendations while protecting detailed sensitive vetting information to allow ministers to make judgments on appointments or on explaining matters to Parliament. So let me be very clear. The recommendation in the Peter Mandelson case could and should have been shared with me before he took up his post. Mr. Speaker, let me make a second point. If I had known before he took up his post that UKSV recommendation was that developed vetting clearance should be denied, I would not have gone ahead with the appointment. Mr. Speaker, let me now move to September 2025, because events then and subsequently show with even starker clarity the opportunities missed by Foreign Office officials to make the position clear. Mr. Speaker, on September the 10th, Bloomberg reported fresh details of Mandelson's history with Epstein, and it was then clear to me that Peter Mandelson's answers to my staff in the due diligence exercise were not truthful, and I sacked him. I also changed the direct ministerial appointments process, so full due diligence is now required as standard. Where risks are identified, an interview must be taken pre-appointment to discuss any risks and conflicts of interest, and a summary of this should be provided to the appointing minister. I also made clear that public announcements should not now be made until security vetting has been completed. Mr. Speaker, in light of the revelations in September of last year, I also agreed with the then Cabinet Secretary, Sir Chris Warmold, that he would carry out a review of the appointment process in the Peter Mandelson case, including the vetting. He set out his findings and conclusions in a letter to me on the 16th of September. He advised me in that letter, and again I quote, "The evidence I have reviewed leads me to conclude that appropriate processes were followed in both the appointment and the withdrawal of the former HMA Washington. when he was asked about this, Mr. Speaker, last week, the then Cabinet Secretary was clear that when he carried out his review, the Foreign Office did not tell him about the UKSV recommendation that developed vetting clearance should be denied to Peter Mandelson. I find that astonishing. As I said out on Olysee, I do not accept that I could not have been told about the recommendation before Peter Mandelson took up his post. I absolutely do not accept that the then Cabinet Secretary, an official, not a politician, when carrying out his review, could not have been told that UKSV recommended that Peter Mandelson should be denied developed vetting clearance. It was a vital part of the process that I had asked him to review. Clearly, he could have been told, and he should have been told. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, on the same day as the then Cabinet Secretary wrote to me, so that's the 16th of September 2025, the Foreign Secretary and the then Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Office, Sir Ollie Robbins, provided a signed statement to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee. The statement says, and again I quote, "The vetting process was undertaken by UK Security Vetting on behalf of FCDO and concluded with DV clearance being granted by the FCDO in advance of Lord Mandelson taking up post in February." It went on to say, and again I quote, "Peter Mandelson's security vetting was conducted to the usual standard set for developed vetting in line with established Cabinet Office policy." Mr. Speaker, let me be very clear to the House. This was in response to questions which included whether concerns were raised, what the Foreign Office's response was, and whether they were dismissed. Mr. Speaker, that the Foreign Secretary was advised on and allowed to sign this statement by Foreign Office officials without being told that UKSV had recommended Peter Mandelson be denied developed vetting clearance is absolutely unforgivable. This is a senior Cabinet member giving evidence to Parliament on the very issue in question. Mr. Speaker, in light of further revelations about Peter Mandelson in February of this year, I was very concerned about the fact that developed vetting clearance had been granted to him, not knowing that, in fact, UKSV had recommended denial of developed vetting clearance. I instructed my officials to carry out a review of the national security vetting process. As I set out, I do not accept that I could not have been told about UKSV's denial of security vetting before Peter Mandelson took up his post in January 25. I do not accept that the then Cabinet Secretary could not have been told in September 2025 when he carried out his review into the process. I do not accept that the Foreign Secretary could not have been told when making statements to the Select Committee again in 2025. But, Mr. Speaker, on top of that, the fact that I was not told even when I ordered a review of the UKSV process is frankly staggering. And I can tell the House that I've now updated the terms of reference for the review into security vetting to make sure it covers the means by which all decisions are made in relation to national security vetting. I've appointed Sir Adrian Fulford to lead the review. Separately, I've asked the Government Security Group in the Cabinet Office to look at any security concerns raised during Peter Mandelson's tenure. Mr. Speaker, I know many members across the House will find these facts to be incredible. To that, I can only say they are right. It beggars belief that throughout the whole timeline of events, officials in the Foreign Office saw fit to withhold this information from the most senior ministers in our system in government. That is not how the vast majority of people in this country expect politics, government, or accountability to work. And I do not think it's how most public servants think it should work either. I work with hundreds of civil servants, thousands even, all of whom act with the utmost integrity, dedication and pride to serve this country, including officials from the Foreign Office, who, as we speak, are doing a phenomenal job representing our national interest in a dangerous world, in Ukraine, in the Middle East and all around the world. This is not about them. But yet it is surely beyond doubt that the recommendation from UKSV that Peter Manchin should be denied development and clearance was information that could and should have been shared with me on repeated occasions and therefore should have been available to this House and ultimately to the British people. And I commend this statement to the House.
Timmy Baird, not Leader of the Opposition.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I thank the Prime Minister for advance sight of his statement. His reputation is at stake. Everyone is watching. It is finally time for the truth. Earlier today, Mr. Speaker, Downing Street admitted that the Prime Minister inadvertently misled the House. The Prime Minister has chosen not to repeat that from the dispatch box. I will remind him that under the Ministerial Code, he has a duty to correct the record at the earliest opportunity. The Prime Minister says he only found out on Tuesday that Peter Mandelson failed the security vetting. The earliest opportunity to correct the record was Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday, almost a week ago. This is a breach of the Ministerial Code. Under that code, he is bound to be as open as possible with Parliament and the public in answering questions today. So let me start with what we do know. We know the Prime Minister personally appointed Peter Mandelson to be our ambassador to the United States. We know that Mandelson had a close relationship with a convicted paedophile. We know that he had concerning links with Russia and China, links that had already raised red flags. We know that the Prime Minister announced the appointment before vetting was complete, an extraordinary and unprecedented step for the role of US ambassador. The Prime Minister says that it was usual for this because it was a political appointment. So I will remind him and the rest of the Labour front bench who were heckling that Peter Mandelson was a politician who had been sacked twice from government for lying. That meant he should have gone through the full security process. And we also know, finally, Mr. Speaker, that when Peter Mandelson failed the security vetting, he was allowed to continue in the role with access to top secret intelligence and security information. This goes beyond propriety and ethics. This is a matter of national security. So let me turn to what we do not know. We still do not know exactly why Peter Mandelson failed that vetting. We do not know what risks our country was exposed to. And we do not know how it is possible that the Prime Minister said repeatedly that this was a failure of vetting, went on television and said things that were blatantly incorrect, and not a single advisor or a single official told him that what he was saying wasn't true. At every turn, with every explanation, the government story has become murkier and more contradictory. It is time for the truth. There are too many questions to ask in the allotted time, Mr. Speaker. So I'm now going to ask the Prime Minister just six questions. And I have taken the unprecedented step of providing these questions to the Prime Minister in advance. So he has them in front of him. And I have asked for these questions. I have asked for these questions to be put online for the public. They and I expect him to answer. The Prime Minister appointed a national security risk to our most sensitive diplomatic post. Let's look at how this happened. The Right Honourable Gentleman told me at PMQs in September 2025 that full due process was followed in this appointment. We now know that in November 2024, Lord Case, the then Cabinet Secretary, told him this process required security vetting to be done before the appointment. He did not mention any of what Lord Case said in his statement earlier. So, first question. Does the Prime Minister accept that when he said on the floor of the House that full due process was followed, this was not true? Secondly, on the 11th of September last year, journalists asked his Director of Communications if it was true that Mandelson had failed security vetting. These allegations were on the front page of a national newspaper. And yet, Number 10 did not deny the story. Why? Three, will the Prime Minister repeat from the dispatch box his words last week that no one in Number 10 was aware before Tuesday that Mandelson had failed his vetting? The Prime Minister says he's furious that he wasn't told the recommendations of the vetting. Yet on the 16th of September, a Foreign Office minister told Parliament, and I quote, the national security vetting process is rightly independent of ministers who are not informed of any findings other than the final outcome. This was the government's stated process. So why is the Prime Minister so furious that it was followed? On the 4th of February 2026, the Prime Minister, fifth question, Mr. Speaker, on the 4th of February 2026, the Prime Minister told me from the dispatch box that the security vetting he had received had revealed Mandelson's relationship with Epstein. How could he say that if he had not seen the security vetting? And finally, Mr. Speaker, Systema is a Russian defence company closely linked to the Kremlin and Vladimir Putin's war machine. Was the Prime Minister aware, before the appointment, that Peter Mandelson had remained a director of that company long after Russia's invasion of Crimea? Mr. Speaker, everyone makes mistakes. It is how you face up to those mistakes that shows the character of a leader. Instead of taking responsibility for the decisions he made, the Prime Minister has thrown his staff and his officials under the bus. This is a man who once said, I will carry the can for the mistakes of any organisation I lead. Instead, he has sacked his cabinet secretary. He has sacked his director of communications. He has sacked his chief of staff. And he has now sacked the permanent secretary of the Foreign Office. All of these people fired for a decision he made. The Right Honourable Gentleman's defence is that he, a former director of public prosecutions, is so lacking in curiosity that he chose to ask no questions about the vetting process. He asked no questions about Mandelson's relationship with Epstein. He asked no questions about the security risk Mandelson posed. Apparently, he didn't even speak to Peter Mandelson before his appointment. It doesn't appear that he asked any questions at all. Why? Because he didn't want to know. He had taken the risk. He had chosen his man. Whitehall had to follow. It is the duty of the Prime Minister to ensure he is telling the truth, or does the ministerial code not apply to him? I'm only holding the Prime Minister to the same standard to which he held others. On the 26th of January 2022, the Right Honourable Gentleman said to a previous Prime Minister at this dispatch box, if he misled the House, he must resign. Does he stand by those words, or is there one rule for him and another for everyone else?
Mr. Speaker, let me respond to those points. Firstly, when I found out what had happened on Tuesday evening last, I wanted to have answers to the question, who made the decision to recommend, to give clearance on developed vetting contrary to the advice, why that was done, and who knew about it, so that I could provide the information to the House, Mr. Speaker. That is the exercise that's been conducted since Tuesday evening and today, so that I could come here today to give the full account to the House, which I've just set out. Mr. Speaker, she asked me about developed vetting security clearance after the appointment. I've set out that wasn't me saying that. I read out the evidence of the former permanent secretary about that and the former cabinet secretary in relation to that. And I think the quotes that I've given to the House are clear enough in relation to that. She also asks why Peter Mandelson failed. Mr. Speaker, it's important to make a distinction between the information provided to the review and the recommendation. The information in the review must be protected and has been protected, because otherwise the integrity of the entire system would fall away. But the recommendation doesn't need to be protected and should not have been protected. Mr. Speaker, in relation to her questions, in relation to the answer about full due process, that was the information that I had that I put before the House, and it was confirmed to be by Sir Chris Wormald, because in September I asked him to conduct a review of the process to assure me that the process was correctly carried out. He did that and wrote to me on the 16th of September, giving me that his conclusions. In relation, Mr. Speaker, to reports in the media, Number 10 was repeatedly asked about the facts surrounding Peter Mandelson's clearance and was assured that the proper process was followed in that case. Mr. Speaker, in relation to those in Number 10, let me give the answer. Nobody in Number 10 was informed about UKSV's recommendation. Mr. Speaker, just to be clear and for the record, the Cabinet Office Permanent Secretary did receive information recently and then sought the necessary and legal advice. Once those checks were completed by the Cabinet Office Permanent Secretary, I was told, that is in the last 2 weeks or so, that was entirely the right procedure, to get the legal advice and then to bring it to my attention at the first opportunity. It was the right procedure that was followed by my officials in the last few weeks. Mr. Speaker, in relation to why I was furious about the process, for the very reason, Mr. Speaker, I strongly believe I should have been given this information at the very outset. I strongly believe there were repeated times when I should have been told. I should have been told on appointment. I should have been told when Peter Mandelson was sacked. The Cabinet Secretary should have been told when he reviewed the process. The Foreign Secretary should have been told before she was asked to sign a statement to the SETNET Committee. And I should have been told when I ordered a review of vetting, Mr. Speaker. In relation to the point she makes about what I said in February in answer to a question of hers, I make it very clear, Mr. Speaker, I had not seen the security vetting file. I did not know that UKSV... The question asked me about vetting. I knew about the due diligence, and that's why I put before the House what I knew about the due diligence in relation to Epstein. The question asked me about vetting, and I knew what the due diligence has said, and therefore I told the House what the due diligence has said. I didn't tell them what security vetting had said, because I hadn't seen the file in relation to that. Mr. Speaker, in relation to the particular details in relation to Peter Mandelson, I acted on all of the information that I had available to me. The simple fact of the matter is I should have had more information. I didn't have that information. The House should have had that information, and I've now set it out in full to the House.
Chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, Dame Emily Thornberry.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The truth is that my committee did ask. We asked on the record, and we got a partial truth that could hardly be the whole truth. But we are on record as asking the very questions that hecklers on the other side say should have been asked. And the answers are there on the record to see just what we got when we did ask.
Exactly.
Mr. Speaker, may I just turn to my question? A month before Mandelson's appointment was announced, the then Cabinet Secretary advised that the necessary security clearance should be acquired before confirming a political appointment. That doesn't seem to have been the usual practice. I'm glad that it's changed, because it was clearly abused. Because what happened was that somebody, probably Peter Mandelson himself, leaked to the press his appointment as US ambassador, effectively bouncing the government into confirming it. But then when the confirmation did come forward about his appointment, it did not make clear that it was subject to vetting in either the offer letter to Peter Mandelson or in the government's press release. I'm afraid to say, doesn't this look like, for certain members of the Prime Minister's team, getting Peter Mandelson the job was a priority that overrode everything else, and that security considerations were very much second order?
Prime Minister.
Well, can I thank her for a question? Her committee did ask relevant questions, and that's why I have indicated that it was unforgivable that the Foreign Secretary was asked to sign a statement in response to those very questions without being told about the recommendation. The questions were asked. She was asked to sign a statement without being told the relevant information, and that is unforgivable. As for the appointment before developed vetting, I've changed that process now so that it can never happen again. And she heard me quote the evidence of the former Cabinet Secretary and the former Permanent Secretary in relation to that. Mr. Speaker, can I just deal with the third point she makes? And that is that somehow Downing Street's wish to appoint Peter Mandelson overrode security concerns. Mr. Speaker, let me be very clear. If I had been told that Peter Mandelson or anybody else had failed security and had not been given clearance on security vetting, I would not have appointed them. A deliberate decision was taken to withhold that material from me. A deliberate decision was taken to withhold that material. This was not a lack of asking. This wasn't an oversight. It was a decision. It was a decision taken not to share that information on repeated occasions.
Sir Ed David, Leader of the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's 2022 all over again. Back then, when he stood on this side of the House, it was Boris Johnson who was accused of misleading Parliament and scapegoating senior officials, the then Leader of the Opposition couldn't have been clearer. The public need to know, he said, that not all politicians are the same, that not all politicians put themselves above their country, and that honesty, integrity and accountability matter. So he promised change, Mr. Speaker. He promised to break the cycle and stop the chaos. And he promised a government with, and I quote, more focus on long-term strategy, not the short-term distractions that can animate Westminster. I'm afraid the fact that he even had to make the statement today shows how badly he has failed. How badly he has let down the millions of people across our country who are so desperate for change. He blames his officials. He says he had no idea. He gives every impression of a Prime Minister in office, but not in power. The facts remain, even on his own account. The Prime Minister appointed Peter Mandelson as ambassador to the United States even after he had been warned about his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. The Prime Minister announced the appointment before Mandelson had been vetted, despite the clear risk to national security of putting someone unsuitable in that role. And one of his top officials, just 3 weeks into the job, clearly believed the Prime Minister wanted Mandelson to be appointed regardless of what the vetting process turned up. And the Prime Minister has relied on the vetting process to defend his decisions. So why did he ask so few questions personally about the vetting process itself? We all know the truth, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister knew that appointing Mandelson was an enormous risk. He decided it was a risk worth taking. A catastrophic error of judgment. And now that it's blown up in his face, the only decent thing to do is to take responsibility. Back in 2022, the Prime Minister rightly accused Boris Johnson of expecting others to take the blame while he clung on. That was not acceptable then, and it's not acceptable now. So I hope the Prime Minister can at least tell the House this, and we'll be listening very carefully to his answer. Was he given advice by Simon Case, the then Cabinet Secretary, that the necessary security clearances should be acquired before he confirmed his choice for US Ambassador? And did he follow that advice, yes or no? Mr. Speaker, after the years of chaos under the Conservatives, we needed a government focused on the interests of the people, the cost of living crisis, the health and care crisis, our national security. We need the government of honesty, integrity and accountability. So will the Prime Minister finally accept that the only way he can help to deliver that is to resign?
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I set out in my statement the full facts. And in September, when the Bloomberg emails came to light, I asked the Cabinet to review the process, then Cabinet Secretary to review the process. He told me the process was as it should have been. And as soon as the information about security vetting came to light last Tuesday, I asked for the facts to be established so I could update Parliament. He asks me about the announcement before developed vetting. He's heard the evidence that I've given to the House from the former Cabinet Secretary and from the former Permanent Secretary. In relation to the advice from Simon Case, Mr Speaker, when I asked the former Cabinet Secretary to review the process after September 25, he specifically addressed whether the process had been followed by referencing the Simon Case letter and assured me that the process was the right process to have followed. So in answer to his question, that was specifically looked at by Sir Chris Warmold in the review that was conducted in September of last year.
Dame Diana. Sorry, Diana, but...
The Prime Minister has gone on at considerable length about process and procedure. But ordinary people don't really care about process and procedure. They want transparency and they want to know that they can have confidence in the words of elected politicians, like all of us in this chamber. On the question of Peter Mandelson, it was in the 90s that Peter Mandelson had to resign from the Cabinet for the first time because of his dealings with the millionaire Geoffrey Robinson. It was a few years later he had to resign from the Cabinet for the second time because of his relationships with the billionaire Hinduja family. Peter Mandelson has a history. Peter Mandelson has a history. And what this House wants to know is why, knowing Peter Mandelson's history, going back now 30 years, and given what has been known, it's one thing to say, as he insists on saying, nobody told me. Nobody told me anything. Nobody told me. The question is, why didn't the Prime Minister ask?
Mr Speaker, in relation to her question, let me be clear. I should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. As soon as the further revelations came to light, I did ask. I asked the Cabinet Secretary to review the process so I could be assured about the process. He wrote to me on the 16th of September, setting out the conclusions of that review and assuring me the process had been followed properly.
Simon Hodger of Packet.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. The Prime Minister has spoken about process and the reviews and trying to put that which went wrong right. That is to be supported. But he's also asking the House and the country to believe that notwithstanding a front-page media splash that Peter Mandelson had failed the vetting process, that there was nobody in Number 10 or in any government department that even thought to say, is there any truth in this? Could I have a briefing on that? We need to knock this story down. If nobody asked, that is the shameful thing. And if nobody asked, does it not say to the Prime Minister that the operation of his government, which seems to be process, strategy, review, never my fault, is not sustainable and is not welcomed by the country at large?
In answer to his question, the FCDA was repeatedly asked in light of inquiries. The same answer came back because a clear decision had been taken that this information was not going to be disclosed. And it wasn't disclosed to me, let alone to anybody else. So, yes, repeatedly the FCDO was asked. The same answer came back as the answer that was given to me. The decision was that I wasn't to know and nobody else was to know. That was wrong.
John MacDonald.
Can I say that on this side of the House, at least, to my honourable friend, many will appreciate his apology today. But many of us will remain bewildered still why that appointment took place, despite the warnings that many of us gave him. And isn't the reality this? That when he sought to realise his ambition to become leader of the Labour Party, with very little base within the party, he became dependent on McSweeney and Mandelson and Labour together to organise, fund his election. And that when he became Prime Minister, the reward for McSweeney was control of Number 10 and for Mandelson, the highest diplomatic office. And the message, the unspoken message to civil servants was, what Mandelson wants, Mandelson gets. This has damaged the party that I've been a member of for 50 years. I urge him to take steps to clear this toxic culture out of our party and take the first step by having an independent inquiry into Labour together.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, can I just deal with what's at the heart of that question in relation to an unspoken message to civil servants? I don't accept that, Mr. Speaker. It is simply not good enough on a question of national security where clearance, the recommendation is clearance be denied, for anyone, particularly senior civil servants, to do anything other than provide me with the relevant information, and that is what should have happened in this case.
Sir Jeremy Wright.
Very much, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has been very clear about his view of the urgency of his response since he learned of this vetting information. So I want to ask him about the events of last week. He will know that the Intelligence and Security Committee asked for any information relevant to vetting to be supplied to it in the first tranche of information we were to consider. We didn't receive anything about vetting at that time. The Prime Minister has told us now that on Tuesday evening he became aware of the information he has set out. But the Intelligence and Security Committee was not told about the existence of that information. Information the Prime Minister must have recognised was within the terms of the humble address and would need to be supplied to the ISC. We were not told by his officials about the existence of that information until Thursday, after it had been published, its existence had been published in the Guardian newspaper. So I am bound to ask the Prime Minister this. If that information's existence had not been disclosed by the press, would we have been told about it? And if so, why did the ISC have to learn of its existence from the Guardian and not from the government?
Prime Minister.
Thank you for his question. And the answer is yes, it would have been provided to the committee. And I think, as he acknowledged, it has now been provided to the committee. The reason for the delay is, on Tuesday night, I found out simply that the recommendation had been made to deny clearance, and yet clearance had been given. I wanted to understand who gave that clearance, on what basis, and who knew about it, so I could update the House and obviously make the information available to the committee. And that's what I asked on Tuesday night my officials urgently to do, so that the full picture could have been put before both the House and the committee. And I'll make sure that the full picture is put before the committee.
Alistair Strother.
Mr. Speaker, many of my constituents are rightly appalled that someone who betrayed not just our country but every single victim of Jeffrey Epstein was able to serve in such a prestigious position. Whatever the judgment in the security vetting file, that decision to appoint him was wrong, and I welcome the Prime Minister's owning an apology for that moment. But many of my constituents are also rightly concerned to learn that not a single democratically elected official in government was informed about that decision. Given this, what undertakings is the Prime Minister instigating right across government to ensure that in the future it's our democratic decision makers who put in the full picture for these crucial judgments?
Prime Minister.
Can I thank him? And Mr. Speaker, that is precisely why I've asked for the entire developed vetting process to be reviewed by Sir Adrian Fulford. And I've made it absolutely clear to this House and to the civil service that my strong view is that the information that was not provided to me could have been provided and should have been provided.
Morello.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister wants us to focus on process and not his judgment. But this entire sorry episode is the direct result of his decision to make a direct appointment to one of the most senior roles in the FCDO of somebody who was wholly inappropriate for the role. Yeah. So can the Prime Minister at least confirm to the House that this was a singular error of judgment and that his Number 10 operation has not proposed political appointee for any other senior role in the FCDO?
Prime Minister.
In relation to the decision, yes, it was my decision. It was an error of judgment, and that's why I've apologised to the victims of Epstein. I've done it again today and right to do so. In relation to the second point of his question, whether any other political appointments, I will have to just check on that and get back to him because I'm not across. There are very many appointments made. There are very many appointments made to senior positions, and I will just check that for him.
Frank Corgill.
Mr. Speaker, the House and the public understand the importance of independent security vetting and why sensitive personal information must be protected, but they are also shocked that decisions of such significance could be taken without the knowledge of the Prime Minister. I have worked closely with the Prime Minister and know how seriously he takes national security and accountability to this House. So can the Prime Minister set out what steps he will take to remove any ambiguity? So where there are serious concerns, those risks are flagged to ministers, ensuring that accountability to this House and to the country is always upheld.
Prime Minister.
I thank her for her question, Mr. Speaker. That is why last week the Chief Secretary suspended the power of the FCDO to make a recommendation or to take a decision contrary to the recommendation of UKSV.
Sir David Deft.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister has twice rebuffed first the Leader of the Opposition, then the leader of the Liberal Democrats, when they said that the then Cabinet Secretary's advice to the Prime Minister was to get the clearance before the announcement. So I'm going to read in one sentence from a document entitled Options for HMA Washington from the Cabinet Secretary of the day to him personally. It says, if this is the route you wish to take, you should give us the name of the person you would like to appoint, and we will develop a plan for them to acquire the necessary security clearances and do due diligence on any potential conflicts of interest or other issues of which you should be aware before confirming your choice. The House doesn't want to hear about what Mr. Wilmot said a year later. That was the advice then. Why didn't he follow it?
Mr. Speaker, he reads out the passage from Mr. Casey's advice. The process that was followed was what I understood to be the usual process. In other words, the appointment was subject to the security vetting. It is why, when Sir Chris Wilmold looked at it in September, he addressed the question by reference back to Simon Casey's letter, because I wanted to know the process that had been followed was the right process, and that is what Sir Chris Wilmold looked at. He looked at it expressly by reference to the Simon Case letter that has just been read out and assured me that the right process was followed when he reviewed it.
Walter.
Q. Mr. Speaker, anybody who knows the Prime Minister will know full well that he would never, ever deliberately mislead this House. But the reality is this, Mr. Speaker, ex post facto vetting is utterly pointless when the appointment is political. And the trouble, Mr. Speaker, that we all face is that trust in the Prime Minister and in politics is diminishing as this sorry saga continues. So in the 17 days we have leading to those very important elections, never mind question, those very important elections, what does the Prime Minister propose to do to win back the trust of the country?
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, in relation to his point about vetting in relation to political appointments, I don't agree, but I do agree that the due diligence for direct ministerial appointments should be the same as for any other appointments. It clearly wasn't, and that's why in September I ordered that it be changed in order to make sure it is the same process, whether it's a direct ministerial appointment or any other appointment. In relation to the country, Mr Speaker, it is important that we remain focused on the cost of living and on dealing with the war on two fronts that we face in this country, and I intend to do that.
Stephen Flynn.
Mr. Speaker, the harshest and most important truth in this entire process is that the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom chose to proactively ignore the victims of Jeffrey Epstein when he made the political choice to put Peter Mandelson in as the UK's most senior diplomat in the United States of America, despite knowing that he had maintained a friendship with Jeffrey Epstein himself. We have since seen Peter Mandelson be investigated for potential misconduct in public office, and we, of course, now learn through the media that Peter Mandelson had failed his security vetting. The Prime Minister blames all of this, all of it, on the judgment of others. But I'm interested in his judgment. Does he believe himself to be gullible, incompetent, or both?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I thank him for his question. I've laid out the relevant facts. It is absolutely clear that nobody is suggesting that this information was made available to me. It clearly wasn't made available. It should have been made available, and I would not have made the appointment had it been made available. That is why I set out the facts in some considerable detail to the House, with relevant quotes from all the relevant players in this.
Stella Creasy.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. The Prime Minister is being candid about some of the challenges in this process. I'm sure he will share the frustration across this House that revelations keep coming and this matter keeps coming back to Parliament. Now, he says that he has acted to prevent any further challenges in the vetting system for the government for senior appointments. Can he therefore give all of our constituents and this House the reassurance that he has no further sense there will be any challenges to any other senior appointments through the vetting process that this government has made?
Mr Speaker, that is precisely why I've asked for a review to be carried out of the security vetting. I have no reason to believe that to be the case, but I want to be assured about the security vetting process, and that's why I've asked Sir Adrian Fulford to look at it so he can give me that further reassurance. I will then, of course, pass that on to the House.
Dame Curran Bradley.
Thank you very much, Mr Speaker. The Prime Minister has just told us that after he sacked Peter Mandelson, he changed the process so that now an appointment cannot be announced until after security vetting is passed. Why did he do that if he didn't think there was a problem with the security vetting?
Well, Mr Speaker, in September, it became clear to me that in relation to the due diligence that had been carried out by the Cabinet Office, Peter Mandelson had been asked questions by my staff and given answers which were not truthful. That was exposed by the Bloomberg emails. At that point, I became concerned about the entire process. I asked for the review of the process by Sir Chris Wormald, which he carried out, but I also made it immediately clear that I would change the due process so that whether it's direct ministerial appointments or any other appointments, the same process was gone through. And I also wanted to make it clear that I didn't think that it was right that appointments should be announced before security vetting was gone through in any circumstances, and therefore I changed it straight away.
Rachel Blake.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My constituents are deeply concerned about the appointment of Peter Mandelson, and they want to see complete transparency going forward. I'm really concerned to read that the civil servants in the Cabinet Office may have had this information about a month ago, and it has taken them this long to be able to be in a position where they can share the information with the democratically elected person making this appointment. What can the Prime Minister share with us today so that we don't have to face this type of issue going forward?
Prime Minister.
Can I address that head on? Because what happened was that the information came to the attention of senior civil servants who were in fact doing the compliance work on the humble address. When they saw the information about developed vetting, they took legal advice straight away to ask whether it was legal to disclose that to me. They got that advice, and as soon as the advice was given, they disclosed it to me straight away last Tuesday. That was the right and appropriate thing for them to do. There's no criticism of what they did.
Rachel Gilmore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We know that last September, MI6's finding that Mandelson's compromising business interests was accurate. I mentioned it myself on September the 15th in 2025. He failed his security vetting. We also know the former Cabinet Secretary advised the Prime Minister to carry out security clearance for Mandelson before his appointment.
Before.
It was reported in the Times yesterday that Mandelson was given strap, very, very highest security vetting, well beyond DV, despite being failed for DV. It is likely that the Americans will have serious questions about what secrets of theirs a compromised British ambassador might have accessed. Despite all this, we also know that the PM and Number 10 were utterly determined to appoint Mandelson as ambassador to DC, come hell or high water. My question is why?
Can I assure her that I have ordered a review of any national security issues arising in relation to what I found out last Tuesday, and I'll obviously update the House when that review is complete.
Dr. Rupa Hupp.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and I also thank the Prime Minister for his heartfelt statement, and, if we're judging parties on actions, not words, for reviving the post of anti-corruption czar. It was vacant for three of his predecessors, years and years, starting with Boris Johnson's lockdown breaches. So can I ask the Prime Minister, now that we have the heavyweight Margaret Hodge in post, what plans does he have for this broader policy area?
Well, I'm sure that Margaret Hodge will do a very good job in that role, as she's done in so many other roles previously.
Sir Julian Lewis.
Who first suggested to the Prime Minister that Mandelson should be appointed as our ambassador to the United States, or was it just his own idea? Did it never cross his mind that Mandelson was at risk of failing the vetting process? And before sacking Oliver Robbins last week, did the Prime Minister ask him why he overruled the verdict of the security vetters? And if so, what was his explanation?
I did ask him, and I didn't accept his explanation. That's why I sacked him.
Rachel Musk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. At the beginning of February, in February 2026, we learnt that Peter Mandelson had shared highly sensitive government information with Jeffrey Epstein from the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. At that juncture, if I was in his shoes, I would have been forensic in recognising a security risk and wanting detailed answers. What's not adding up for me is why we are now in mid-April before we get this information, and why the Prime Minister didn't drill down to ensure that we had the security information, which clearly we learnt that Peter Mandelson had breached.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it was at that point that I did ask, order the review of the security vetting, because I was concerned that it had failed. In fact, because of information I wasn't given, it hadn't failed. It had actually given the recommendation that clearance should be denied. the fact that when I ordered a review of UKSV, senior officials in the Foreign Office didn't at that stage, if at no other stage, bring to my attention the information they hadn't told me, is astonishing, because I was ordering a review of the process, which I was which looked as though it had failed, when in fact it had flagged the relevant concerns.
So, Oliver Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Further to the point from my honourable friend, the member for New Forest West, I think the Prime Minister does owe it to the House to tell us what Sir Ollie Robbins' response to him was when he said he'd overrule that advice. Because in my experience, senior officials are actually very keen to deliver on the wishes of ministers, particularly a newly elected Prime Minister. And my concern here is that implicitly, as other members have made the point, Sir Ollie Robbins was responding to a desire from the Prime Minister, because it was perfectly clear in all of the newspapers the allegations are out there about Peter Mandelson, but the Prime Minister had decided to proceed anyway. The official wished to deliver on the desire of the Minister. That's why he overruled the advice, and I fear also gave him a degree, the Prime Minister, a degree of plausible deniability.
Let me answer that in relation to Sir Ollie. Let me start by saying he's had a distinguished career, and I must say that, and I do say that. I still, notwithstanding that, he should have provided this information to me, and he could have provided it to me. He's giving evidence tomorrow, but I can say to the House that when I spoke to him on Thursday, his view to me was that he couldn't provide this information to me because he wasn't allowed to provide the information to me. I don't want to put words in his mouth, because it's very important he gives his own evidence. In relation to the question that's being asked of me, when I said why wasn't this shared with me, he did... I've been asked what questions I put to him, and I've been asked the answer, and I'm trying to give that answer. I'm trying to give it without putting words into Ollie Robbins' mouth, because I don't think that's fair of me to do so. But what he said to me was essentially that he took the view that this process did not allow him to disclose to me the recommendation of UKSV. No doubt he'll be asked further questions about that. He did. That is the reason that he gave to me.
Sarah Champion.
There are 61 conflicts raging around the world. I've never known international diplomatic relationships be more fractured. FCDO is pushing through 40% cuts of aid and 25% cuts of staff, all under the watch of the permanent undersecretary. So can I ask the Prime Minister, what risk assessment was carried out before he was removed?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I was dealing with a various issue. I asked my team to establish urgently the facts on Tuesday night. I spoke to the former Permanent Secretary on Thursday night. As a result of the information I had and the exchanges I had, I made it clear that I no longer had confidence in him.
Lee Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The problem the Prime Minister's got is no one believes him. The public don't believe him. The MPs on this side of the House don't believe him. His own gullible backbenchers don't believe him. So does the Prime Minister agree with me? He's been lying.
Prime Minister, sorry, we don't use those words, and I'm sure the members withdrawn it.
Mr. Speaker, I have the greatest respect for you and your office, but I will not withdraw. That man couldn't lie straight in bed.
The order. Mr. Anderson, you'll have to leave. Phil Brittle.
Speaker, when Sir Ollie Robbins came before the Foreign Affairs Committee on the 3rd of November last year, he was asked by my honourable friend, the member for Liverpool Walton, whether, in the context of vetting, Lord Mandelson's appointment was escalated. Citing a need to maintain the integrity of the vetting system, Sir Ollie replied, and I quote, "I certainly cannot comment on that, I'm afraid." Does the Prime Minister not find it perverse that when specifically asked by members of this Parliament about Mandelson's vetting, Sir Ollie declined to discuss the very topic we are now debating in this House?
Prime Minister.
Well, I've read that evidence, and it remains my strong view that the recommendation of UKSV could and should have been shared with me and could have and should have been shared with the Foreign Secretary and thus with the Select Committee, and it should have been.
Andrew Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Further to the question raised by my right honourable friend, the member for Hardswear, Mr. Speaker, is it not pretty poor form that the Prime Minister shovels the blame for this, particularly onto Ollie Robbins, a fine and experienced civil servant who was appointed 2 days after the Prime Minister's Mandelson announcement? Surely, Mr. Speaker, the buck stops at the top.
Prime Minister.
Can I say again, Sir Ollie Robbins has had a distinguished career and I've worked with him over a number of years. Nonetheless, he could and should have shared this crucially relevant information with me before Peter Mandelson took up his post, and he should have done at various points after that. And it was because of that that I lost confidence in him. That doesn't mean he hasn't got a distinguished career. He does have a distinguished career.
Joan Davey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And I thank the Prime Minister for his statement. I know the Prime Minister is aware that public confidence in politicians needs to drastically improve in order to retain the public's trust. With this in mind, Reform has been accepting donations from millionaires in cryptocurrency, making it difficult to trace who actually funds them. Does the Prime Minister agree that Reform relying on millionaires' dodgy cryptocurrency is a security risk?
Mr. Speaker, we've taken a number of measures in relation to crypto.
Relevant, don't worry, let's move on. Stephen Bartley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the readout of the Prime Minister's meeting on the 15th of April on vetting, it says, and I quote, "There is no evidence that the decision to grant DV, despite the UKSV advice, had been disclosed to anyone outside FCBO and UKSV until the vetting document itself was shared with the Permanent Secretary of the Cabinet Office." Is he therefore saying that neither the Chair of the Joint Committee on Intelligence nor the National Security Advisor were aware of this security risk with our most important strategic ally until the vetting document itself was shared with Cat Little?
Prime Minister.
I'm so sorry. I understand that to be the case. Obviously, no, I'm only saying that. It wasn't my decision to withhold it. I understand, if I've understood Sir Ollie's position correctly, that his argument is he can't share it or he couldn't share it with anyone. With anyone. That's as I understand it. Certainly wasn't shared with the National Security Advisor. I don't think it was shared with anybody else. But it's a question that as far as I know, it hasn't been until it was seen by my officials, legal advice was taken and shown to me. It wasn't shared with anybody else.
Rinda Singh Jossa.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Prime Minister for his statement and the clarity contained within that and for his apology again. Despite the protestations of leaders of the parties opposite and members opposite, and including some on these benches as well, I'm sure everybody in this House agrees that the government of the day should take advice of our intelligence and vetting services and act on it. Yes. In view of everything we have heard, and this is a fundamental question for me, how can government act on intelligence service and vetting advice if ministers never get to receive that advice?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, in many instances, it's the recommendation of UKSV that is effectively the final decision. So, of course, it's known. In the Foreign Office, there is the additional part of the process in which the final decision is, in fact, taken by the Foreign Office officials rather than the recommendation of UKSV. That is what has now been suspended, so that in the Foreign Office as well, the recommendation of UKSV is what matters.
David Robinson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister knows that he is the main character in an ongoing national scandal. And given all the blame apportioned in his statement, it is incredible that only one person has lost their position. But would the Prime Minister also recognise it is incredible to learn that in Northern Ireland a political appointment was made following the refusal to clear an individual for security access, that they have continued in their post, engaged on issues connected with the legacy of our troubled past with full security clearance, despite security service concerns, and they continue to this day. So if the Prime Minister is ordering a review by Sir Adrian Fulford, will he ensure it includes within its terms of reference or separately a deep dive into the appointment of Marie Anderson, the Northern Ireland Police Ombudsman? Why she was appointed, why the security information was ignored, and how this can be the case.
Prime Minister.
Can I thank him? And I will ensure the review covers all the relevant issues and material, and I'll take into account what he's just said.
Murrigan.
The Prime Minister has the right to expect that his senior civil servants will always tell him the truth and the whole truth. He will recall that Mrs. Thatcher used to say of Lord Young that she liked David because he always brought her solutions and not problems, while her other ministers brought her problems. Does he believe that there is a problem within the civil service, that promotion and advancement is on the back of not giving your ministers problems, and that on this occasion the senior official at the FCDO knew that if he did tell the Prime Minister what he ought to have told the Prime Minister, he was bringing him a problem?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank him. Can I just be clear? We have thousands of civil servants acting every day with integrity and professionalism, doing the job to their very best ability. As I understand what Sir Ollie is saying, he is saying that he believed he couldn't give me this information, that he was prohibited from doing so. I disagree with him. I think he could and should have given me this information, but I don't think that is any reason to suggest that across the civil service people act for any improper motive.
Sir Bernard Jenkins.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I just point out that the developed vetting process has always been highly protected, because otherwise it wouldn't work. People would not give information to the developed vetting process if they thought that any detail of that was likely to be disclosed, or even if the result, the assessment, low, medium or high risk, was likely to be exposed. And that is why the previous Labour government in 2010 wrote into the Constitutional Reform and Governance Act, Section 3, in order to prohibit that disclosure. And if he is now saying that developed vetting is now going to be available to ministers on a routine basis, wouldn't he be undermining the very process upon which we depend for our national security?
Prime Minister.
With respect, I don't agree with his analysis. I certainly agree that the information that's provided into the process by the applicant has to be protected, because as anybody who's been through the process will know, it's an incredibly detailed and intrusive process, and it's very important that individuals give full and truthful accounts of all the questions they're giving to them. That is why that needs to be protected. I do not accept that means that the recommendation of the UKSV cannot be shared with ministers, including the Prime Minister. I think there's a distinction between the two. I accept the first. I utterly reject the second.
Jane Kirkham.
The Foreign Office shared the outcome of the vetting process, but not the conclusions of the vetting reports. Not just the detail, but the conclusions too. If the Prime Minister is going to own a decision, he needs to know what is within it. What changes will he be making to stop this happening again?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank you for a question, and that's why I've asked for a review of the entire process so it can be looked at from start to finish, including the question of whether there should be any circumstances in which the recommendation of UKSV cannot be followed.
These are small.
Speaker, I'm going to try again, because a number of members and right honourable members have asked a question and I'm not quite sure I heard an answer from the Prime Minister. Why did the Prime Minister choose to ignore the advice from the then Cabinet Secretary, Simon Case, to seek security vetting before confirming Peter Mandelson as his pick?
I understood the procedure to be that the appointment was made subject to the security vetting. That's what I was told. But the question she raised is the question I raised in September, which is why I asked Sir Chris Wilmot to look at the process and in particular, he looked at the advice, the letter from Simon Case, to answer the question, was the process followed? And he gave me the answer that he thought right, having concluded that process.
Don't be Abraham.
And I thank my right honourable friend for his statement. But for clarity, could he confirm to whom and when the UK security vetting report outcomes were made available? And also, what guidance is given to senior officials on matters that must be escalated to their ministers?
Prime Minister.
The process was that UKSV informed FCDO of their findings and their recommendation, and then there's an escalation process. It's part of the process in the sense that it is the FCDO in these particular cases to make the final decision, which is what they did in this case.
Sir Ian Duncan Smith.
Speaker, I'm going to return again to the real nub of what this is. The Prime Minister knew, as we all knew, about his representation as to who should actually be the ambassador. In this particular case, a man that had been sacked twice out of cabinet, but more than that, in the public domain at the time were all his links clear with the Chinese companies and his meetings with Xi. Furthermore, his time in Sustema, where he stayed there after 2014 in the invasion, not just for that, but his meetings with Putin, and of course his relationship with Deripaska, who was negotiating on the tax levels and the tariffs on aluminium when he was the EU commissioner responsible. So with all of that going on, his announcement of this man into the ambassadorial position, why did he think that therefore he didn't know something about him? He knew he was corrupt, he was corrupting, and he was the wrong choice. Surely that's why he overturned Case's review, Case's advice to have the review before he made the decision.
Prime Minister.
No, that's not the case. But the judgment call to appoint him was my judgment call, and that was an error, and I've apologised for it, particularly to the victims of Epstein. But the develop vetting process was carried out in the way I've indicated to the House. I should have been told at the time of the recommendation. Had I been told, I wouldn't have made the appointment.
Neil Duncan Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today's statement may well be about process and procedure, but surely, Prime Minister, the real issue is why, when Peter Mandelson's reputation was already known, was he ever considered for such an important role?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've accepted that was my decision and I've apologised for it.
Ellie Chalmers, Dr. Ellie Chalmers.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister says it's staggering and unforgivable that he wasn't told about the vetting. But what's really staggering and unforgivable is that he appointed Peter Mandelson before the vetting, that he appointed Peter Mandelson knowing about his friendship with the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. What's unforgivable is that the Prime Minister was more concerned with pandering to Donald Trump than with standing with the victims and survivors. Now, the Prime Minister has not accepted a simple sorry from his civil servant. He thinks that's inadequate. The country thinks a simple sorry is inadequate from him. Yeah. Will he take personal responsibility for his staggering and unforgivable errors of judgment and resign?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've set out to the House the facts of what happened in this particular case, and I am staggered, and I find it unbelievable. I wasn't given the information I should have been given.
Richard Bergen.
Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister made the political decision to appoint Peter Mandelson, but central to that decision, along with other policy and political position decisions, would have been the Prime Minister's former Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney. So can the Prime Minister confirm to the House whether Morgan McSweeney passed all his security vetting and confirm whether or not Morgan McSweeney ever handled documents for which he had anything other than the appropriate level of clearance?
Prime Minister.
All the appropriate necessary developed vetting has taken place in Number 10, and everybody has passed that. Everyone passed it.
Francois.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. If, as we've been assured, there was no law that prevented the Permanent Under Secretary telling the Prime Minister the outcome of Mandelson's developed vetting, then presumably by the same token, there was no law that prevented the Prime Minister from asking.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can he be very clear with the House on one point? Did he, as Prime Minister, ever ask the question, did Mandelson fail his vetting? And if he did ask that question, who did he ask that question of, and when did he ask it?
Prime Minister. Peter Mandelson was given developed vetting clearance. That was the clear position. He was given clearance. That's the facts as I've set them out.
Clive Efford.
The Prime Minister has always behaved with the utmost integrity and honour when he's been dealing with this House, and he is an eminent lawyer who understands the consequences of deliberately coming here to mislead Parliament. On top of that, he also understands the likelihood of a paper trail unravelling such a deception. So it's inconceivable that he would intentionally mislead this House. But does he agree with me that all of the documents relevant to this matter must be made public in accordance with the humble address that was passed on the 4th of February, and that no ministers or officials should engage in trying to prevent any of those documents being made public?
Minister.
Yes, we will comply with the humble address in full. That is the process that's going on.
Mr. McBay.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister said today, I know many members across this House will find these facts to be incredible. Yeah. He's right. Yep. We do, along with his staggering lack of curiosity and his inability to take on board warnings about his good friend Peter Mandelson. Because the Prime Minister was given a due diligence document by the Cabinet Office, which told him several reasons why Peter Mandelson should not be appointed. Fired twice from government, business dealings in Russia and China, and the fact that he'd maintained a relationship with Epstein after his imprisonment for paedophilia. The Prime Minister knew this, but appointed him anyway. Why, Prime Minister? Why?
Prime Minister.
Peter Mandelson was asked various questions on the back of the due diligence exercise, and he didn't tell the truth in those answers. But look, the decision to appoint him was an error. It was my error, and I've apologised for it.
Sir Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is accepted by many on these benches that the Prime Minister did not know the outcome of the vetting. But the Cabinet Secretary came on Tuesday, and she had clearly spent a month researching whether or not she could provide the advice that she did. So she clearly thought very carefully about the information that she brought. When the Prime Minister then launched an investigation, rather than coming straight to the House with the information that she had provided, was that because the information was insufficient to present to the House? And if so, when was he planning to come to the House?
Prime Minister.
Yeah, it was insufficient because all it told me was that the recommendation of UKSV was to deny clearance. What it didn't tell me was who then provided the clearance, why did they do it, and who knew. And they were questions that the House obviously would want to raise with me, and that's why I urgently asked for those facts to be established so I could come to the House today and provide the full account that I have provided to the House.
Colin Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ballot vetting should be carried out before someone has, and I quote, frequent and uncontrolled
access to top secret material or any access to top secret or coded, otherwise known as strap material. The Prime Minister has promised full transparency, so I ask him three questions. Did Peter Mandelson have access to any top secret or strap material before his DV clearance on the 29th of January? Did Peter Mandelson have any restrictions placed on his access to top secret or strap material during his time in Washington? And if so, has the Prime Minister assured himself that Mandelson did not leak any of this material, just as he had leaked commercially confidential material to Jeffrey Epstein under Gordon Brown?
I do not understand that he had access to strap material before he took up his post as ambassador. He did have access after he took up his post, and that is why I have ordered a review of any security concerns that may arise.
Justin Maddox.
Mr. Speaker, I think we all find it staggering, don't we, that someone can fail their security vetting and still be appointed to such a sensitive and critical role. And it's even more staggering, as we've heard, that the Prime Minister wasn't informed of that failure. Now, I agree with what the Prime Minister said. He didn't need to know the details, but he did need to know that he'd failed the security vetting. And it's in terms of the detail that I want to ask the Prime Minister this. If people didn't know what the concerns were on security for Peter Mandelson, how could any minister, how could any official, how could any other state deal with him on sensitive security issues? I understand the Prime Minister's doing an inquiry into that, but it's very important that Parliament has oversight of that issue, because I'm very concerned there's been another failure there to manage our security interests.
Prime Minister, I thank him. In a case such as this, in relation to such a sensitive post, I don't think it's right that somebody should be appointed at all if the UKSB are recommending that clearance is not given. So that would be my position on this.
So John Page.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. When I was privileged to serve as Security Minister, the Prime Minister was my shadow, and dealing with matters of the most significant national security, he was straightforward with me, as I was with him. So I hope he'll answer this straightforward question. The humble address made clear that the ISC will see any material related to national security or international relations. In the course of our work, we've clearly liaised with the Cabinet Office. When did the Cabinet Office know about this failure in vetting? Who knew? And why didn't they bring that material to the ISC when they found it? For we hadn't received it when he found out that this vetting had failed. And yet others must have known that it had failed.
Prime Minister.
Would you just excuse me? The situation was that as part of the work that was being done on the humble address, this information came to light. Senior officials immediately took legal advice on whether it could be disclosed. Having got that legal advice, they immediately disclosed it to me. I think that was the proper process. I think it has now been disclosed to the committee, albeit I think on the Thursday rather than the Tuesday, but that's the process. Just to defend that process, I do think it was right for the senior officials, having got this information, to get legal advice on whether they could disclose it and who to. I think that was the right thing to do. As soon as they got that advice, they brought it to my attention.
Lawrence Turner.
Disgraced himself and by extension brought shame upon these two houses of which he was formerly a member. Does the Prime Minister agree that the famous Armstrong memorandum on the conduct of a civil service was correct and holds true today when it said, "It is the duty of a civil servant to make available to the Minister all the information and experience at his or her disposal which may have a bearing on the policy decisions to which he is committed or preparing to make, and to give to the Minister honest and impartial advice without fear or favour, and whether that advice accords with the Minister's view or not?"
Prime Minister.
Yes, I do agree with that, and that's why this information could and should have been shared with me at the first opportunity, and that was before Peter Mandelson took up his post as ambassador.
Liz Savile-Roberts.
The Prime Minister is hiding behind a thicket of legalese and procedure, but he has a track record of appointing Labour's most favoured sons and daughters to plumb government jobs and into the House of Lords. In Wales, we know all about Labour's crony culture. Who could forget UK Labour's favourite First Minister, Vaughan Gething, propped up by Number 10 in spite of dodgy donations, and now tipped for a peerage. But the timing, Mr. Speaker. How will he explain to his party his role in bringing down Labour's century of dominance in Wales in the forthcoming elections?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm addressing the question today about the process in relation to Peter Mandelson. I've set that out in some detail to the House and answered a number of questions.
Afsana Begum.
In December 2024, the Prime Minister said in announcing Peter Mandelson as US Ambassador that he had unrivalled experience. This was despite the gravity of what was known about his record and available publicly. Is it not the case that Peter Mandelson's political appointment, which was personally decided by the Prime Minister and announced in public before the security vetting was completed, needed to progress and had to happen, however it happened, because of Mandelson's role in the Prime Minister's own leadership campaign and because it served the interests of one particular faction in the Labour Party?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I don't accept that is a reason for withholding from me the information about security clearance.
John Whittingdale.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The result of the Prime Minister's terrible failure of judgment is that for over a year, this country's interests were represented in the United States by someone that our own security services deemed to be a security risk. Will he assure us that an investigation will take place into all aspects where our national security may have been damaged, and that the results of that will be made available to the Intelligence and Security Committee and, where possible, to Parliament?
Prime Minister.
Yes, I will.
Thank you,
Mr. Speaker. I believe there's two sides to this. One is about process and the other one is about judgment. On process, I believe the Prime Minister, where the Prime Minister was not told about the security vetting clearance, and had he have known, he would have sacked him. That we don't have a problem with, but the problem is, why wasn't he told that, and who's actually running the country, and whether other ministers are kept in the dark by civil servants? On judgment issue, it was wrong, and completely wrong in the first place, to put Mandelson forward as an ambassador. Will the Prime Minister write to me confirming this week that no one is in position who has failed the advanced security vetting process of all political appointments that have been made?
That is included in the review that I've set up, and as soon as I've got the findings, I'll share them with the House.
Dave Dougal.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This saga is drawing to a close, and it will come to a conclusion with the Prime Minister's resignation, whether he can accept that or not. What I can't accept is the "ask me no secrets and I'll tell you no lies" regime that he expects us to believe prevailed at the very top of government between officials, and not just ministers, but the Prime Minister. He talked a lot today about what he didn't know and what he wasn't told. Well, he knew that Mandelson had a serious human frailty for other people's wealth. We knew that Mandelson was involved with the Russians. We knew that Mandelson was sacked twice as a government minister. Can the Prime Minister explain what was Mandelson's actual qualities that he was pursuing in the role as US ambassador, and what steps has he taken to contain the serious and measurable breach in national security that his appointment of Peter Mandelson facilitated?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've made it clear it was an error to appoint Peter Mandelson. There is a review going on into any security issues that may arise.
Laura Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I welcome the Prime Minister saying that he should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. In November in the Foreign Affairs Committee, I asked about who sees vetting and was told by Sir Ollie Robbins, obviously the vast majority are relatively straightforward, ones that require more senior judgment and potentially a discussion about managing and mitigating risks are escalated appropriately. Questions being asked by the Foreign Secretary or ministers or officials in Number 10 should have been a signal to the civil servants to escalate this matter, given the controversial nature of this political appointment. So I would like to ask the Prime Minister whether concerns about links to Epstein, to other countries or anything else were raised by him in conversations about his appointment at just before the time of his appointment that would have signalled that civil servants should escalate this.
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, there are two different processes. One was the due diligence process carried out by the Cabinet Office, in which Peter Mandelson was asked questions. Separately, there was the developed vetting process, in which the recommendation of UKSV was not shared with me until Tuesday evening.
Then Harriet Baldwin.
It seems to me that there are two different ways in which a minister can inadvertently mislead this House. One is by the things that they say, but one is by the things that they don't say. And that is why I'm particularly interested in the letter that my right honourable friend, the member for Goole and Pocklington, raised, the one from Lord Case, because that seems to have been written to the Prime Minister in November 2024, advising that a political appointment to an ambassadorial role ought to be preceded by full security vetting when it was before it was announced. Now, it was announced by the Prime Minister in December 2024. Did he write on his decision there that he wanted it to be subject to him passing the full security vetting? What did he write on his box note?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I understood it to be subject to developed vetting, but it was because of the process that in September 25 I asked Chris Wormald to do a review for me of the process, and he did that by reference back to the Simon Case letter.
Thank you, Speaker. I'm sure the Prime Minister is aware of the damage that this saga has done to public trust in politics and in politicians. However, I would like him to confirm that his focus and the focus of his government is on the issues that matter most to my constituents in Banbury, in particular tackling the cost of living.
Prime Minister.
Well, absolutely, Mr. Speaker. The focus of me and the government is on the fact that we're facing a war on two fronts with serious consequences for our country, and that we absolutely need to deal with the cost of living, which is the number one issue for all of our constituents up and down the country.
Richard Ford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How did views from the United States administration affect the decision in the Foreign Office to persist with Mandelson as UK ambassador to Washington, D.C., after the vetting advice was received there?
Prime Minister.
I don't believe that they did. This was UK security vetting carried out in the way I've described to the House. The issue is that the recommendation was not shared with me. That was a matter here in the United Kingdom.
Peril Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I thank the Prime Minister for his statement? Could the Prime Minister provide the House with an update on the proposed legislation to remove peerage from disgraced peers like Peter Mandelson, who has fallen so far below what is expected of those serving in the House of Lords?
Prime Minister.
Yes, I've made a commitment in relation to that legislation, and work is progressing on it.
Dame Caroline Dynage.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. At the risk of stating the obvious, the Prime Minister has based his defence today and over this whole sorry saga around his claim that he wasn't told. He wasn't told that Mandelson failed security vetting. In fact, he said 11 times in his statement that he wasn't told. Mm. I'm just wondering how many times and on which specific dates did he himself directly ask for that information?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, it's not a claim I wasn't told. I wasn't told. And I don't think anybody is disputing that. The clearance was given on the 29th of January 2025. That information was not provided to me. In September, I did ask specifically about the process. I did ask about the process. Sir Chris Wormald has made it clear to me that in carrying out that review, he was not told about the security clearance recommendation that was made. I think on both occasions that information should have been provided both to me and to the then Cabinet Secretary.
Chris Hinchcliffe.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Prime Minister for his statement. In answer to my honourable friend earlier in this statement, the Prime Minister said that he delayed coming to this House so that he could answer, amongst other questions, why UKSV was overruled. It seems wholly incredible that this decision was made on a personal whim by a senior civil servant. And is it not
that it was made because of the political pressure from Number 10 to advance a man who a particular faction in the Labour Party has looked to for moral and spiritual leadership for years. So can the Prime Minister explicitly now confirm his understanding of why the decision to overrule UKSV was made?
Well, Prime Minister...
Mr Speaker, I don't accept that the view of anyone about Peter Mandelson could provide an explanation for not providing me with the information that he had. The recommendation was not to grant him security clearance. We're talking about a very serious issue on a very sensitive case. I clearly should have been given that information, whatever the pressures that are always there in government every day.
Robert Jenner.
The Prime Minister's aides brief that he's furious, angry Starmer. But why is it that he only ever seems to get angry when he's trying to save his own skin?
Yes.
Is he not angry about the 600 men who crossed the English Channel on small boats on Saturday? Is he not angry about the people who are queuing up for fuel at the forecourts and can't afford the Chancellor's taxes? Isn't the truth that his government is now so paralysed that its only agenda is cleaning up the mess left by the paedophile pal, Peter Mandelson?
I think any minister of any government that hadn't been provided with this relevant information would rightly be frustrated and angry.
Emily Darlington.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I wanted to take a moment during the statement to focus on the young women who were exploited, abused, raped by Jeffrey Epstein and his friends. Years of being trafficked for rape, no one to turn to, and years of people not believing them. The idea that Mandelson would call Epstein's conviction wrongful is disgusting. And I cannot imagine how it felt for the survivors to hear that. The PM was right to sack him, so can I ask the Prime Minister to take the opportunity again to say to those young women that this House believes them and this government stands by them, and is he confident that no person with financial or personal links with sex traffickers would receive DV in the future?
Can I thank her? And she's right to focus on the victims in this, and that's why I started this statement by making it clear that this was a judgment error on my part, and the apology I have made is to the victims, because I know the impact that this will have had on them who have already suffered so very much.
Katie Lamb.
The Leader of the Opposition asked this question, but I don't believe received a response. Was the Prime Minister aware that Peter Mandelson was a director of Sistema before he was appointed?
Prime Minister.
Mr Speaker, I acted on the information that was provided to me in the due diligence process. The information that was dealt with in the security vetting process has not been made available to me, nor can that detail be made available to me. It's the recommendation that should have been made available to me.
Arthur Brash.
Mr Speaker, one of the things that I find most difficult to understand in this process is that when this scandal erupted in September of last year, and before the Prime Minister came to this place and elsewhere to make statements about it, statements that he must have known would have involved talking about the vetting, why he simply didn't order officials to share the vetting with him. Why didn't he, and does he regret not doing it?
Well, I did ask Sir Chris Wilmore to carry out a review. I worked on the basis that all the relevant information would be shared with him. It was only last week that I found out from Sir Chris that he himself had not been provided with the information that he should have been provided for when he was carrying out the review on my behalf.
Chairman Corbyn.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. Can I take the Prime Minister back to the question asked by the member for Hackney North and Stoke Newington some while ago, when she asked a quite simple question, why the Prime Minister didn't ask any questions whatsoever about the nature of the security clearing that Mandelson had achieved, or why there was any doubt about him, or was he so obsessed with his determination to appoint this tainted figure to be the ambassador to Washington, he just wanted to ignore the rest, and the officials just went along with it? Why didn't he ask the simple, straight question?
Mr. Speaker, Peter Mandelson was given security clearance, and that was clear to everyone, including myself. He was given clearance. He was cleared. He wouldn't have started the role if he hadn't been given clearance. As soon as it came to my attention last week that that was against the recommendation of UKSV, I did ask for the information I've now put before the House.
Melinda Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We all agree that Peter Mandelson should never have been appointed, and the Prime Minister has said this clearly and consistently and taken responsibility, including by apologising. That is the right thing to do. Can the Prime Minister give further assurance that the government will continue to comply with the humble address in full?
Yes, I can give that assurance. We will.
John Lennon.
We got that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
The Prime Minister said various things over the course of the last few weeks and months, which have now turned out not to be true around the vetting process of Peter Mandelson. Does the Prime Minister accept he inadvertently misled the House of Commons?
Yeah.
Prime Minister.
No, I did not mislead the House of Commons. I accept that information that I should have had, and information that the House should have had, should have been before the House, but I did not mislead the House, and that's why I've set out the account in full.
Jacob Collier.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Bloomberg files, which caused the Prime Minister to sack Peter Mandelson, revealed that Mandelson had been leaking confidential government information to a convicted paedophile during Gordon Brown's government. In his role as ambassador to Washington, there will have been access to highly sensitive and top secret documents. So knowing that this was his previous behaviour, is there any investigation by the government or security services into potential leaks during Mandelson's tenure as ambassador?
That's why I've asked for a review to be carried out in relation to the material that could have caused any issues in relation to national security.
Luke Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. On the 12th of September, it was revealed in the Independent newspaper that Mandelson did not pass vetting by MI6 and therefore by UKSV. On the 16th of September, in this chamber, my honourable friend, the member for Tiverton and Minehead, made the same claim in the presence of the Minister, the right honourable member for Cardiff South and Penarth. On hearing this information, did the Minister or the Prime Minister feel the need to ask if the specific claim there was true? And in the response that was given, that DV clearance was granted by the FCDO, as a KC, how did he not see the clear difference between the question that was asked and the answer that was given? And does he not agree with me that, in his own words, his explanation beggars belief?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, at various points questions were asked, and questions were therefore put to FCDO. The answer back was the same, because they took the view that was not information they could share with anyone, including myself.
Dr. Tullison-Gar.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Early today, NBC released an interview with hospice worker Rachel Benavides, who was 22 years old when she became one of the victims of Jeffrey Epstein's abuse. For 27 years, she has been waiting for the crimes committed against her to be recognised. And as she told NBC, and I quote, "Until we are heard, until survivors are heard and believed, then I don't think there's ever going to be justice." Does the Prime Minister agree that we owe it to the hundreds of victims like Rachel to put them first in these debates, not political point scoring, and that he was absolutely right to sack someone like Peter Mandelson, who refused to believe these victims, and if he did not care?
Well, I do agree with her, and can I thank her for making sure that the victims are central in this, as they should be.
Dr. Andrew Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has been on his feet now for nearly 2 hours. So can I put it to him that the most charitable explanation that can be put forward to explain this sorry saga is that it has been a bad, probably terminal case of the three wise monkeys. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil.
Yes. Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I've set out the procedure in some detail. Information should have been provided to me. It was not provided to me. If it had been provided, I would not have allowed the appointment of Peter Mandelson to proceed in the way that it did.
Joanna Baxter.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As we have heard, it's absolutely staggering that vital information on UKSV recommendations can be withheld from ministers taking decisions. Can the Prime Minister assure the House that in the review he is commissioning, that we examine whether any other instances in which UKSB recommendations against granting DB status, whether there are any other instances of that over not just the period of this government, but the last 14 years, because they have potential to have very serious security implications.
Well, I do think that needs to be subject to the review, and that's why, amongst the reasons, I've put the review in place.
Christine Jordan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. It must be clear to the Prime Minister that many of us in this House are totally scunnered with this whole mess. But believe me, that's nothing compared to what I'm being told in the doors in Scotland by voters who feel that they expected and were right to expect more from this government after what they were promised. We've focused on process today, but the Prime Minister wouldn't have had to come here, wouldn't have had to stand at the dispatch box, answer all these questions, if he had not made the decision, which he accepts was wrong, to appoint Peter Mandelson. That's the root of this whole thing. So having accepted responsibility, what does the Prime Minister think the consequence should be for that, and how do we restore faith?
Can I just help the Prime Minister and help everyone in the room? There's a lot still trying to catch my eye with a lot time. Please help each other. Let's speed up the questions, Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I've accepted the error judgment on my behalf, but I was not provided with information. Had I been provided with it, I wouldn't have made the appointment.
Kim Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. This morning, the Scottish Minister said that to deal with an unconventional US administration, we needed an unconventional ambassador. So, Prime Minister, does unconventional now mean appointing a man to a senior position when we know his lies, his corruption and misconduct has provided corruption at the very heart of our democracy now? And can the Prime Minister tell us when he first knew of the evidence and the advice and why
order,
he ignored
order,
it?
Order. Please, let's get other people in. Prime
Minister. I first knew last Tuesday as I've set out to the House.
John Bale.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Now for the third time of asking. At the time when the Prime Minister appointed Peter Mandelson as ambassador, was he aware that he had been a director of Systema?
Mr. Speaker, I was aware of what was in the due diligence, and I've dealt with that. I wasn't aware of what were the issues that were dealt with in the security vetting, nor the recommendation of UKSB.
Well, Pinto Jatinski. Colvin Bailey, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mandelson's appointment was a huge failure of the British state, and I welcome the Prime Minister's candour in accepting his responsibility for his part in it. But does the Prime Minister agree that restoring public trust is a mammoth task and requires leaders on all sides to be careful with their language and to ensure that they understand the processes that they're talking about rather than throw about baseless accusations of, quote, lying?
I do agree with that, Mr. Speaker.
John Robertson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister has been absolutely clear that he should have been shown the recommendation of UK security vetting. He knew he hadn't seen it, so why didn't he ask for it?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the first I knew that there had been a recommendation to deny clearance was Tuesday evening of last week. The security clearance had been given by the Foreign Office before Peter Mandelson took up the post. As soon as it came to my attention, I sought the information I put before the House today.
I'm going to take Kevin Binney on a bit, and then I'm going to take Steve Darling. Kevin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Members of the public watching this matter would have been baffled by all the speculation about who said what and when. So I thank the Prime Minister for his calm, clear answer today. But no Prime Minister wants or should be in a situation like this, where governmental processes mean that critical information are not brought to the attention of ministers. Yep. So I welcome the thought of a review. But will the Prime Minister look at the wider relationship between government ministers and civil servants so that trust can be restored?
Prime Minister.
Yes, I will look at that, but I do just want to assert again, thousands of civil servants act with professionalism and integrity every day. On this occasion, this information should have been brought to my attention. Had it been, the appointment would not have been proceeded with.
Natalie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. During this session of Parliament, we have seen the head of the OBR carry the can and resign due to an error by a member of his team. What will it take for this Prime Minister to carry the can?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I was not provided with information I should have been provided with. Yep. Had I been provided, I wouldn't have made the decision. It was a deliberate decision. It wasn't negligence. It was a deliberate decision not to tell me.
Natalie.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I thank the Prime Minister for his statement, and I thank him even more for the apologies on the appointment of Peter Mandelson. And being here today, I want to commit the words once again to the record of Virginia Giuffre. I think they are particularly relevant to Peter Mandelson. She said, "Don't be fooled by those in Epstein's circle who say they didn't know what Epstein was doing. Anyone who spent a significant amount of time with him saw him touching girls that you wouldn't want a creepy old man touching your daughter. They can say they did not know he was raping children, but they were not blind." Now, on the House, across the House, there is consensus that we need to get to the bottom of this. I absolutely accept that the Prime Minister did not know about the security vetting. But can the Prime Minister please update the House on when we can have the next tranche of documents from the humble address so that we can get to the bottom of who did know what and when?
Prime Minister.
Can I thank her for her campaigning on behalf of these victims and many other victims in relation to abuse, sexual abuse in particular, and her insistence always that we must put the victims first. We are complying with the humble address as quickly as possible, and we will comply with it fully.
Alfred Blundrew.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In the Foreign Affairs Committee meeting back in November last year, I asked Sir Oliver Robbins whether the Foreign Office had a different view about who should be recommended for the posting of ambassador. Sir Oliver Robbins said to me that the Prime Minister took advice and formed a view himself, and we then acted on that view. Isn't it the case that the Prime Minister was repeatedly warned before the appointment that Peter Mandelson carried reputational and political risk, including that due diligence was not exhaustive and that vetting was not yet complete, and yet he chose to proceed regardless, announcing the appointment, overriding civil service advice and putting our national security at risk?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I simply don't accept that there's any good reason why I couldn't have been provided with the information that was withheld from me. Had it been provided to me, I wouldn't have proceeded with the appointment.
Alison Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I thank the Prime Minister for such a clear and comprehensive statement? I'm sure the whole House is grateful to him for doing so. Listening to the party opposite, the old adage about throwing stones in glass houses comes to mind. I don't think there are enough glass houses in Scotland to replace the ones that they are breaking today. However, Mr. Speaker, having set the record straight, does the Prime Minister agree with me that it's now the time to return to the important business of government in preserving the country's peace and security?
Prime Minister.
Yes, I do agree that the absolute focus needs to be on the fact that we're facing a war on two fronts and a cost of living crisis which this government is gripping.
Sammy Wilson.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister has told us that the Cabinet Secretary gave him bad advice, Peter Mandelson lied to him, and the Foreign Office didn't tell him anything. He's really in danger of being known as the Mushroom Prime Minister. Kept in the dark and fed, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, Mr. Speaker. I'm not saying it. But is it a question that he wished to remain in the dark?
Yep,
he knew in September there was a security vetting, and yet he never asked about it until April of this year. Surely that's an indication that he was quite happy to be kept in the dark because he'd made his mind up anyway.
Yes. Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker. What I did was ask for the process to be reviewed. Sir Chris Warmall carried out that review. What transpired last week is that information was withheld from him in the review. So I asked for the review. I did ask the questions. He gave me his conclusions. What neither he knew nor I knew was that he too was not told the relevant material in the course of that review.
Whereas, Mr. Speaker, and I welcome.
There we are, the Prime Minister on his feet for 2 hours or so, so far, nearing its end there. Keir Starmer addressing MPs about Peter Mandelson's vetting for the job as US ambassador. He rejected suggestions that his desire to appoint Mandelson overrode security concerns, insisting Foreign Office officials made what he called a deliberate decision not to tell him Mandelson had failed vetting. It's not a lack of asking, he said, but a decision taken not to share information on a number of occasions. The opposition leader, Kemi Badenoch, said the story was murkier and murkier and more contradictory. And Diane Abbott, former Labour, now independent, said, it's not enough to say nobody told me, nobody told me. The question is, why didn't the Prime Minister ask? Another point of the afternoon was the Reform MP Lee Anderson was kicked out after refusing to withdraw an accusation that the Prime Minister had lied. Let's bring in our political editor, Beth Rigby. Good afternoon or evening, Beth. I mean, very difficult time for Keir Starmer. Has he done enough to survive, at least in the short term?
Well, look, Mark, I mean, this is difficult times for the PM for sure. And that was a laden with process series of exchanges there in the Commons today, wasn't it? And what this is about at the heart of the Commons action is whether or not the Prime Minister knowingly misled the House. Now, if he had done that, he could be in contempt of Parliament. And we know what happened to Boris Johnson when MPs decided that that was the case with that former Prime Minister over the Partygate scandal. And so in terms of what did Keir Starmer need to do today, he had to come and say, I did not mislead the House. Due process, here's my explanation of what happened, here to correct the record and explain how he did not know that Mandelson hadn't passed developed security vetting, as he tried to blame other people, only taking responsibility in the fact that he did say at the top of his statement that it was wrong to appoint Peter Mandelson, that that was his judgment, that he made a mistake on that, and that he did apologise for the original decision to appoint Peter Mandelson. But beyond that, it was really a mountain of defence of the decisions he made on the basis that he was kept in the dark. But I think if go back to the question about can he survive it, there's no smoking gun here that's put him in immediate peril. But I think there's lots of things that are politically very difficult, Mark. For one, you saw his own MPs standing up there to criticise his judgment, to criticise the way that Number 10 is being run. Emily Thornberry, the chair of the Foreign Affairs Select Committee, said security seems to be a secondary consideration here. Such was the desire to appoint Peter Mandelson. John McDonald and Diane Abbott, yes, they're not Starmer fans. They are on the left of the party, but both of them criticising the Prime Minister, saying that this was all about his former Chief of Staff, Morgan McSweeney, and what he wanted. John McDonald talking about a toxic culture in Downing Street, and I hear that a lot from MPs privately. And then, of course, Kemi Badenoch really putting in the sting there. She likened Keir Starmer to Boris Johnson, saying, well, you asked Boris Johnson if he misled the House to resign, and there's one rule for him, for a former Prime Minister, and another for you. So none of it comfortable for Keir Starmer. But if you said to me, was there a smoking gun that materially changes the situation he's in, I would say there isn't. But that was not comfortable. And actually, one MP who had said to me earlier this morning that he thought Keir Starmer was safe came back to me after that statement saying he thought it was abysmal and he thought it was very worrying that Starmer loyalists sat stony-faced on the benches there.
Yeah, and of course, there's another angle to this, the fact that he sacked very quickly Sir Ollie Robbins. Now, he gives evidence tomorrow. In a way, I guess they're both on the same side because Ollie Robbins is saying pretty much the same thing. But, I mean, he's become the scapegoat. What are the potential pitfalls for the government tomorrow?
Well, you're right, Mark. I mean, Ollie Robbins has had a torrid time in recent days. And one of his allies, Tom Fletcher, who's the UN humanitarian chief, he was on the Today programme on the BBC this morning defending Ollie Robbins, saying that he is a public servant of the highest order. He is full of integrity and saying that he'd had a rough few days and he was a strong character, but he's completely heartbroken about what has happened. And from Ollie Robbins' perspective, allies of Robbins tell me that Ollie Robbins doesn't think he's done anything wrong, that he followed the process, that the Prime Minister, despite red flags being raised in December, in early December by the Cabinet Office, went on to announce the appointment of Mandelson before the security vetting, and then it was Ollie Robbins got the developed security vetting back, and then it was his job to mitigate the risks, and that is what he probably will say he has done. He will argue I didn't do anything wrong, and yet I am being scapegoated for this. And so it is still heat on the Prime Minister, because there are questions about whether or not he didn't follow advice to get that developed security vetting, or the security vetting done before the appointment was announced. He was saying in the Commons that that was normal practice. Simon Case, the Cabinet Secretary, the then Cabinet Secretary, back in the end of 2024, recommending something else. So it's going to be quite a moment to hear what Ollie Robbins said. I don't think that Ollie Robbins is going to be vindictive, but I do think that Ollie Robbins feels aggrieved, and I think that he wants to defend his reputation and defend what he did. But at the heart of it, you're right, Mark, that Ollie Robbins is effectively agreeing with the Prime Minister that he did keep this developed vetting from the Prime Minister. And you heard Keir Starmer in the Commons there saying, had I known this, I would not have appointed Peter Mandelson. And that's the defence he's mounted. But for a former director of public prosecutions, which is what Keir Starmer was doing before he became Prime Minister, it does seem for many incredible that he didn't ask more questions, that he wasn't more curious. And that's why you heard opposition MPs jeering when he said it was an incredible version of events, because they simply don't find it believable. But at the moment, his MPs don't seem ready or willing to begin to try and oust him. They've got May elections coming up, but this does not help Keir Starmer at all. He was a Prime Minister that came in promising to have accountability in office, to do politics differently, to serve with integrity, and he's been dragged to the Commons to say he didn't mislead the House. And it does remind you of some of the dying days of the Conservative government, and I think that that, for Keir Starmer, that criticism from Badenoch will really sting.
Yeah, OK. Beth, thank you very much indeed. Let's go to our chief political correspondent, John Craig, who's in Parliament's central lobby. And you've been talking to some MPs. John, what are they all making of it?
Well, the Conservatives, of course, are noting the fact that there wasn't a huge amount of support for the Prime Minister from his own backbenchers. A lot of MPs have suggested to me that Sir Lindsay Hoyle's wreaking his revenge on Sir Keir Starmer for last week's Prime Minister's questions by calling all the Labour troublemakers, John McDonnell, Diane Abbott and so on, who did give the Prime Minister a tough time. I'm joined now by Alex Burghardt. He's the Shadow Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, key Kemi Badenoch ally, attack dog for the Tories. What did you make of what you heard from the Prime Minister?
Well, I just heard a load of waffle from the Prime Minister. Kemi Badenoch gave the Prime Minister six questions in advance, said, this is what I'm going to ask you. Yeah, you always try to get around asking my questions. Well, here they are. And he didn't answer any of them. And I think there's a simple reason for that. It's because the truth is painful. The truth is he was in possession of more than enough facts when he appointed Peter Mandelson to know that he shouldn't have done it. He was in possession of more than enough facts to know that Peter Mandelson was a potential security risk to this country, and yet he sent him to our most sensitive diplomatic role anyway.
She didn't directly call for the Prime Minister's resignation, which she has done a number of times the last few days. She's called him a liar and so on. She perhaps went, as you said, six questions, perhaps the more forensic approach. Should she not have been a bit more blunt? I mean, Ed Davey called on the PM to resign.
Over the weekend, Kemi was quite clear that the Prime Minister's position was untenable and that he ought to step down, that what he's done has been very damaging for national security. Either this is, you know, grotesque incompetence, or it's dishonesty, or it's both. It's probably both.
I understand that Kemi Badenoch, after the next statement on anti-Semitic attacks, is going to call for an emergency Commons debate tomorrow. Why are the Conservatives doing that?
We want to make sure that we get every available opportunity to hold the government to account before the House prorogue. So we're going to have a break before the King's speech during the local elections. So we're trying to get as many answers out of the Prime Minister and the government as possible, and we'll use whatever parliamentary tools are available to us to do that.
And what is the motion going to say in terms of why you need an emergency debate?
Well, I'm, under the rules of the House, I'm not allowed to talk about that beforehand, so afraid you'll just have to keep watching.
You just did.
No, I haven't confirmed or denied anything. We're just going to use everything in our at our disposal to try and hold the government to account.
And you want to keep the pressure up, obviously.
Absolutely. We got Prime Minister's questions on Wednesday. Also tomorrow morning, Ollie Robbins, who's the sacked senior Mandarin from the Foreign Office, is going to be giving evidence to the Foreign Affairs Select Committee and be very interested to hear his side of the story. But you know, what the Conservatives have been saying for several months now is that the government, the Prime Minister, made an appointment he knows he shouldn't have made, and he's thrown everybody else under the bus. He's thrown his Chief of Staff under the bus, he's thrown his Director of Communications under it, he's thrown the Cabinet Secretary under it, and now he's thrown the Chief Civil Servant in the Foreign Office. You know, ultimately, as Kemi keeps saying to him, it's his responsibility, it's time he took it.
Labour MPs I've spoken to seem to think the Prime Minister survived this. OK, he's had a tough time in the House of Commons, but he survived this. He lives to fight another day. Do you think perhaps that your attack on him hasn't worked?
No, I think that you speak to Labour MPs in private. They're very.
Well, I've spoken to them in private.
Okay, well, me too. And you know, they don't really see him leading them into the next election, and that becomes a question of when and not if. And, you know, that means that every time the Prime Minister is shown to have either been dishonest or incompetent, it adds to the weight of the case against him.
Which of the potential successors do the Tories fear?
None of them.
OK, Alex Burkhart, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A very bullish and buoyant Alex Burkhart. Tories don't fear any of the candidates to replace Sir Keir Starmer, he says.
Right, OK, John, thank you very much. And I was just saying that Lee Anderson, the Reform MP, was thrown out of the Commons a little earlier for failing to withdraw an accusation that Keir Starmer was a liar. Well, Sir Lindsay Hoyle's at it again. In the last few minutes, he's thrown out the former Labour MP, now your party MP, for Coventry South, Zara Sultana. Let's have a listen to what happened.
Zara Sultana.
Speaker, in September, the Prime Minister stood at this dispatch box and told the House he had full confidence in Peter Mandelson, a man whose relationship with convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein was public knowledge. The Prime Minister knew and backed him anyway. Now he claims he had no idea that this twice-fired government minister had failed MI6 vetting, despite journalists putting that directly to Downing Street that very same month. Yeah. Mr Speaker, we all know that the Prime Minister appointed Mandelson because he owes his job to him.
Yep.
He appointed him, he defended him, and now he claims to know nothing. He is gaslighting the nation. So yep. Let's call this out for what it is. The Prime Minister is a barefaced liar, and if he had indecency left.
No, order, 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 sit and leave. Leave now. I'll name you otherwise and go now if I were you. Leave. I'm not. Leave. I've no name. I've given the option to leave. I'd leave if I were you very quickly. Move before I read it and give me one option. Right, give me that. You have no duties. It's my duty to carry out and control this house. One chance. Do you want to leave? No, we're not. Right. I name Zara Sultana. Minister, I beg to move that the name, the said member, be suspended from the house. I really am. Right. Come on, Rebecca.
So there we are, two in short succession kicked out for failing to withdraw that The Prime Minister is a liar. Joining me now is former Labour adviser John McTurn. And I guess this goes right to the point, doesn't it? You know, this idea that he knowingly misled the House. Do you think he did enough to persuade people that he didn't knowingly mislead the House?
I think on that narrow point he did. And I think it was, I think you've been discussing before that basically, discussed it with Beth, I think, that tomorrow Sir Ollie Robbins will broadly corroborate the case of Keir Starmer. And I think what's interesting is we're spending the time talking about the Mandelson vetting. That's what is up on the side of the screen. The issue wasn't the vetting. The issue was the appointment, not the process, the actual decision. The decision came first. The appointment was made. The king was then got to make the appointment. And after that, the civil service has to act like a Rolls-Royce machine and make sure that the government, the prime minister, gets the man that he wants. And the issue is, why on earth did you want this man? Whose idea was it?
Yeah.
And but why just, did you but agree there with is it?
A, yeah, sorry to interrupt, but on this point of the process, I mean, Keir Starmer kept saying due process was followed, but it obviously wasn't. We now know that Simon Case told the Prime Minister that all security vetting of political appointees needed to be done before the appointment. I mean, the point was, John, that didn't happen.
Oh, look, I think that's the issue. Again, you're right. The advice from the then Cabinet Secretary was, if you're going to make a political appointment, then make them go through a process before you announce the appointment, before you actually make the appointment. And in this case, the appointment was made, announced, endorsed by the King, while other processes were going through. It's like giving you the job before we've read your references and then going, oh dear, that was a bit of a mistake. And look, and I think, can you imagine the situation that Sir Ollie Robbins would have been in had he had to go, do you know what, I'm going to have to make the King withdraw this offer, I'm going to have to make the Prime Minister withdraw this offer. And remember, at the end of 2024, just what a poor reputation for communications the Labour government had a series of disasters, and then to have one decision like this and then having to unravel it. So I see Sir Ollie was put in a very difficult situation. The problem was the actual appointment, which was at the time indefensible. And the thing about things that are indefensible is you sound like you're defending the indefensible when you try and defend them. So even when you focus on the process, the vetting, the information flows, whatever, you're still in the end not really challenging the fact that the fatal error was to even consider that somebody who'd stayed overnight in a convicted paedophile's home while they were in jail, they shouldn't have been considered for any public office. And I think that's
he admits he's guilty of a lack of judgment. But, I mean, if you want to go down that road, he was definitely in possession of more than enough facts to realise that this would be a mistake when he did it.
I agree. And I just don't understand why it even came into the mind. Well, I understand why. It was thought to be a great idea. It was thought to be a big decision at a time when the government was struggling in getting any cut through. Well, they've sure got the cut through with this decision, and they've sure had the follow up of the cut through. And it's, you know, it is a kind of lacerating pain for the Parliamentary Labour Party and for the Labour government.
Doesn't Diane Abbott have a point when she said, you know, it's all right to say nobody told me anything. The question is, why didn't the Prime Minister ask? Doesn't she have a point?
Yeah, look, I think Diane's very often got a point, and I wish she was back in the Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party. And she's right that when you're considering somebody for one of the most important offices you can appoint anybody in public life to, you should have some curiosity and not offshore this off the curiosity and not just, you know, contract it out. This is a thing for which, you know, all the tar should have been kicked before this even became announced as an issue. It just became an inevitability, and one can tell from some of the correspondence that was released from inside Number 10 around this appointment. Jonathan Powell said, this is weirdly rushed. And I think that there was no need to rush. There was a need to get this right.
OK, John, appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. And as we were just saying, the Reform UK MP Lee Anderson was kicked out of the Commons after accusing Keir Starmer of lying and then not withdrawing it. Let's have a listen to that.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The problem the Prime Minister's got is no one believes him. The public don't believe him. The MPs on this side of the House don't believe him. His own gullible backbenchers don't believe him. So does the Prime Minister agree with me? He's been lying.
Prime Minister, please.
Sorry, we don't use those words, and I'm sure the member's withdrawn it.
Mr. Speaker, I have the greatest respect for you and your office, but I will not withdraw. That man couldn't lie straight in bed.
The order. Mr. Anderson, you'll have to leave.
Mr. Anderson joins me now. What evidence do you have that the Prime Minister lied?
My inbox. That's the evidence. That's all the evidence I need. My inbox is full of people absolutely furious with our Prime Minister. They're saying that he's lying, he's misleading the British public, he's misleading Parliament. And yeah, you know what?
What evidence do you have? What evidence do you have?
Well, there was evidence on the front of the Independent.
Or believe
there was, like there was evidence on the front of the Independent newspaper about 7 or 8 months ago to say that Mandelson had failed the vetting procedure. Now, are you seriously telling me that the Prime Minister, his staff, his advisers, none of his MPs read that newspaper on that day?
But he was given clearance. He was subsequently given clearance.
Yeah, well, that just shows how many problems they've got with...
But that's the point if you're talking about lie. I mean, he's saying he didn't know Mandelson failed vetting because the Foreign Office didn't tell him. He said he knew about the due diligence, but not about the security vetting.
It's absolute nonsense. The buck stops with the Prime Minister. If people aren't telling him, then he's in the wrong job. He's the leader of this country. He's the Prime Minister of this country. I don't believe a word he's been saying, and neither does his backbenchers. And I think Diane Abbott was probably asked one of the best questions today. He's always blaming somebody else for his own mistakes. I think he's covering up. And look, it doesn't take a genius to work out that Peter Mandelson is a wrong'un. He had to resign twice in the 1990s for Cabinet. He's had this deep friendship with the world's worst paedophile. I mean, to give this man a job, come on, let's be serious. Who would employ this man?
Look, I mean, the Prime Minister admits he made a mistake. There was a lack of judgment there.
It's not good
enough. You're saying he was lying. I mean, the point was that the Starmer is making is that Mandelson was subsequently given clearance, so why would he ask if he was given clearance?
It's absolute nonsense. Everybody in this country you speak to, anybody you speak to in the bubble, in the world of politics, in Westminster, just any man on the street knows that Peter Mandelson is a wrong, and nobody would employ this man anywhere. This man, our Prime Minister, gave him a job.
Your point was that Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, was... Look, Ollie Robbins is going to say tomorrow, we think he's going to say, yeah, that he believes he did the right thing, and some will argue that the fact that others are saying Robbins was right not to tell the Prime Minister is of itself proof that the Prime Minister is not lying.
It's absolute nonsense. Look, why isn't Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, asking his staff, asking these officials serious questions about the appointment of this man? Everybody in this country knows that Peter Mandelson is a wrong'un, is not fit to be doing this sort of job. Why isn't the Prime Minister asking these questions? It's a cover-up from start to finish.
But you can accuse him of a lack of curiosity, inquisitiveness. You can accuse him of a lack of judgment, but I'm not hearing from you any real evidence that he lied.
Well, I'm not interested in what you've got to say or what you've got to say on the matter. All I know is that my inbox is full of people thinking the Prime Minister is a liar. The backbenchers where I sit in Parliament, they all think he's lying. When you look at his own backbenchers, they think he's lying. This man is not fit for office. He needs to resign straight away.
But letters in your inbox are not proof that he's lied.
Well, it doesn't matter. I'm there to represent my constituents, and when I get in that chamber, I'm there to represent my constituents. And if they think he's lying, I actually believe them. I think he is lying. I will go in that chamber and I will ask questions on their behalf. Somebody needed to say this in the chamber, and unfortunately, they're not brave enough in the other political parties. Reform UK will ask the difficult questions, and that's why I did it today. I think he's lying, I think he's misleading the British public, and I think he's misleading Parliament.
Right, just finally, I mean, isn't it basically a bit of Lee Anderson reform attention-seeking?
No, it's not attention-seeking at all. This is the thing that you lot don't understand. You lot don't understand in the media and in the bubble that people out there in the real world are asking real questions about our Prime Minister. I'm prepared to go in the chamber and ask these real questions and get answers. Unfortunately, I didn't get an answer, and I'll stick to my point. I think the Prime Minister is lying.
All right. Lee Anderson, thanks for coming on. Now, in the last few hours, the Prime Minister has been battling for his political future over his decision to appoint Peter Mandelson as US ambassador. He delivered an explanation of events to MPs that he hopes will be enough to quell the calls for his resignation after it emerged that Mandelson was hired even though he had failed security vetting. Sir Keir Starmer insisted that he could and should have been told that his pick for one of the UK's most sensitive diplomatic posts had been deemed unsuitable for the role. He blamed the Foreign Office and officials, arguing the process allowed them to tell him, but they didn't. That, he said, was staggering. But the Tory leader claimed the Prime Minister hadn't asked questions because he didn't want to know, and that his story was getting murkier and more contradictory.
I want to be very clear with this House that while this statement will focus on the process surrounding Peter Mandelson's vetting and appointment, at the heart of this, there is also a judgment I made that was wrong. I should not have appointed Peter Mandelson. I take responsibility for that decision, and I apologise again to the victims of the paedophile Jeffrey Epstein, who were clearly failed by my decision. Let me be very clear. The recommendation in the Peter Mandelson case could and should have been shared with me before he took up his post. Mm-hmm. Mr. Speaker, let me make a second point. If I had known before he took up his post that UKSV recommendation was that developed vetting clearance should be denied, I would not have gone ahead with the appointment. Mr. Speaker, I know many members across the House will find these facts to be incredible. To that, I can only say they are right. It beggars belief that throughout the whole timeline of events, officials in the Foreign Office saw fit to withhold this information from the most senior ministers in our system in government. That is not how the vast majority of people in this country expect politics, government, or accountability to work. And I do not think it's how most public servants think it should work either.
The Right Honourable Gentleman's defence is that he, a former director of public prosecutions, is so lacking in curiosity that he chose to ask no questions about the vetting process. He asked no questions about Mandelson's relationship with Epstein. He asked no questions about the security risk Mandelson posed. Apparently, he didn't even speak to Peter Mandelson before his appointment. It doesn't appear that he asked any questions at all. Why? Because he didn't want to know.